is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
For me, the tectonics of the presidential election has opened up fissures in the American landscape wider and pushed to the surface with some terrible volcanic force, the racism, sexism, xenophobia, that is really the bedrock of this country. This eruption was fueled by all of the principal players of the Republican Party, albeit most advantageously by Trump. It is embedded in the DNA of the Republican Party and the 45th president now of the United States. And the fact of these malignancies, so easily stoked, is an important reminder. Like a boil that must be lanced for the host to be healed, this election has revealed the toxicities of American society that must be reckoned with, which we ignore at our peril. These biases serve as a fundamental challenge for people of conscience to confront in their institutionalized form and when individually expressed. But then, as well, there was the Democratic primary, where tens of millions rallied to Bernie Sanders' call for a political revolution, advocated sweeping changes in the U.S. society as a whole, which also gives us fertile ground in which to plant and grow our social justice movements. Now we can begin to exhale. The die is cast, and we can begin to think more deeply about what this election means for the terrain in which activists campaign once the new president is inaugurated, for the movement for Black Lives, the struggle for climate justice, the movement for immigrant rights, and more. We have now been joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, Chair of the History and African American Studies Department at the University of Houston. He is a prolific author of more than 30 books, Struggles Against Imperialism, Colonialism, Fascism, and Racism. And he joins us to give us his takeaway of the complex social, political, and economic issues raised by the national election. Gerald, how are you feeling?
The takeaway from this historic election is that the crisis of whiteness and the crisis of white supremacy has now become a crisis for the planet. Sadly, this leads to a self-indictment, self-criticism of much of the left. When there has been talk of white identity politics and white nationalism, that has come from the mainstream press, more so than many of our left-wing analysts. When they speak of identity politics, oftentimes they think that they should be speaking about Black people. This should lead to an indictment, not only of many of our left analysts who didn't supply many of us with the tools to anticipate this earthquake. I think many of our pundits, many of our analysts, many of our historians need to walk the plank, particularly the historians, because what you have seen was a reassertion of whiteness, white supremacy, and male supremacy, too. But if you look at the historians, they give us this fairy tale about how the United States was created. Instead of talking about it as the first apartheid state, they talk about it in terms of these supposed eternal principles that could then be extended to the rest of us. Where the white electorate and its majority has just told us is that they're in open revolt against not only multiculturalism, not only feminism, they're in revolt against Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. They're in revolt against most of the changes of the last 60-odd years. There is a bit of good news, but even that leads to a criticism. It's apparent that Trump's policy on Russia made much more sense than Hillary Rodham Clinton's policy on Russia. There was two choices between the two major candidates. One was Hillary Rodham Clinton, which says confront Russia first. Donald J. Trump says confront China first. Now, both policies are insane, but in the short term, it makes more sense to work with Russia to combat religious zealotry, particularly in Syria, as opposed to working with religious zealots, which is what has been happening, to confront Russia in Syria and indeed throughout the world. So this crisis that I'm talking about is also a crisis for the planet. There's going to be a walking away, obviously, from the Paris Climate Accord, which puts all of humanity in peril. There is a looming confrontation with China, because that's what people basically voted for, whether they realize it or not, that cannot be won.
Well, Gerald, I think the predominant factor, and it's not just an opportunistic stoking of the fault lines of racism and sexism and xenophobia. It is racism, sexism, and xenophobia that is at the DNA of the vote that garnered people of the white working class to come to the table for Trump, and indeed do not feel that it was any less so for the college-educated people who the pundits and pollsters seem to be surprised also went for Donald Trump. It does not seem that the economic insecurity is the fundamental issue. Shall we say, what role does that play for these groups of people, some of whom are not nearly as insecure, that they might be in Appalachia or other areas, but are still voting for Trump?
It would be vulgar to reduce this election to the economic factor. When Michael Moore has spoken about the working class, he's really actually only talking about the white working class. But he doesn't use that term. He just speaks of the working class. And, of course, it's not him alone. That's a general trait. And yet, it's not just the working class. Who has suffered more than the black working class in recent decades? But the black working class did not turn to the right. So then you need to ask the question, then why did the white working class turn to the right? Once again, there is a general upset with all of the changes that have taken place in recent years and decades. And even if you look at the trade question, lurking behind the trade question is the question of China. And, of course, Donald J. Trump says confront China first. Indeed, I think when historians, assuming that we can overcome climate change, when the historians turn to this episode, they'll focus on a very important meeting that took place in October 2016. In Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles Museum of Art, where China's richest man, the head of the Wanda Group, which controls AMC theaters, which of course are scattered throughout New York, had a meeting with Hollywood titans where they basically came to kiss his ring, and where he laid down the new law with regard to themes going forward in Hollywood, which is, of course, more Chinese-related themes, more Asian actors, more Chinese actors, etc. This did not go down very well. Look at the New York Times coverage of that very important episode, because Hollywood is part of the ideological armor of U.S. imperialism, and now even that bastion seemingly has been breached. If you look at the reaction to the Oscar So White campaign, the sharpest, most negative reaction did not come from a so-called Euro-American actor, like Tom Cruise, for example. It came from Charlotte Rampling, an Anglo-French actor who complained. So Hollywood has been very important in terms of the imperial projections of U.S. imperialism. And when you talk about trade and when you talk about the changing global economy, you're basically talking about the second largest economy on the planet, which is China, about an economy which the late Nobel laureate Robert Fogel said that within decades might have an economy 10 times larger than that of the United States. And in fact, in terms of the tectonic changes that we're going to be witnessing, some of which are too awesome to really contemplate, I think you can basically bet on a new alliance between China and Mexico. The Mexican peso has been taking a pounding. Mexico is going to be an early target of the Trump administration. China's going to be an early target of the Trump administration. It makes sense for them to unite against U.S. imperialism. This is just one of the many changes I think you can expect going forward. I don't think that people are really aware of the enormous alterations in the global correlation of forces they've just set in motion.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about were some of the possible cabinet positions. John Bolton, who essentially wanted to eliminate the United Nations as Secretary of State, Rudy Giuliani as a potential Attorney General, the fact that we've made some inroads against the death penalty, it's virulent advocacy by Trump, as we know, going back to even 1989. When the Central Park Five were minors, and his taking out full-page ads in a number of newspapers calling for the death penalty against these five young men, who of course have since been completely exonerated and no apology there from Trump still to this day. I mean, these are some of the things that are almost would be overwhelming. How do you see, with this tremendous onslaught and in many ways consolidation of what I would certainly consider to be, proto-fascist forces, what do you think that is the responsibility or how the left can confront what almost seems to be this terrifying juggernaut of ultra-right reaction that is about to sweep the country and be legitimized in the form of this presidency?
Well, first of all, I think the left should set a good example by engaging in some serious self-criticism. With its unwillingness or inability to analyze whiteness and white supremacy, once again, the crisis of whiteness was an article in the New York Times just a few days ago. You rarely hear our folks on the left talking about that. We need to realize how we got to this point. What happened over the past 60 years was not only the retreat of Jim Crow, which in many ways led many white workers to think that they were in a now stiffer competition with workers of color, particularly black workers, but there was an overdetermination of Moscow over the past 60 to 70 years by the U.S. ruling class, and some of our friends on the left went along. Arguably, a major turning point in world history took place in the early 1970s when President Richard M. Nixon went to China and worked out an anti-Soviet entente with Beijing, and part of the payoff was this massive inward direct foreign investment to China, which has now created this juggernaut. And that was a turning point in world history. When you extended that anti-Moscow policy to the domestic scene, it meant routing the left wing in the labor movement. Progressive forces in the labor movement were not able to survive, to the point now where we've arrived at this juncture where Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, who comes out of the miners' union, obviously is not able to deliver his numbers. West Virginia went for Trump. Not only that, but Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, the word on the street now is that he's going to start aligning with the Republican caucus in the Senate so he can get a chairman seat. If you look at the election that led to the reelection of Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader from Kentucky, he, of course, triumphed in eastern Kentucky, which is coal country. So obviously, there has been a debilitating of the labor movement. There has been a debilitating of the left wing of the labor movement. But all of this was part of a larger global strategy of this anti-Moscow psychosis. And the chickens have now come home to roost. The whole thing is just madness. But once again, the crisis of white supremacy and whiteness is now the crisis of the entire planet.
One of the things I had on from ProPublica, very astute journalist who's done some very interesting and important articles during the election season, one of the things that he was saying is Alec McGillis, he said, now wait a minute, you got it wrong about white supremacy in this instance, that a lot of the areas, the issue of racism is vitiated by the virtue of the fact that a number of these areas that have voted for Trump previously actually voted for Barack Obama. So therefore, the issue is economic insecurity. It is not about racism. How would you address a comment like that?
You can make a credible argument that this election was also about male supremacy. There has not only been an erosion of so-called racial privilege in recent decades, there's been an erosion of male privilege. So to suggest that counties that voted for Obama did not vote for Clinton does not help us to escape the dilemma. One of the problems we need to confront is that at least we can say about the major victims of racism, that is to say the black community, they don't necessarily vote for racism. They try to vote against the right wing. But Donald J. Trump, like most Republicans, won the vote of white women. Now, how he did that in light of the Access Hollywood tape and the Billy Bush tape and being a confessed sexual predator, that's something that I think we're going to have to try to confront. Certainly, I think that this easy invocation of the term gender gap needs to be re-examined. Because if you remove black women from that gender equation, you don't necessarily have a gender gap. You have a gender non-gap. And that needs to be explained. And one of the ways to explain it is just like white workers, male workers, oftentimes do not reflect voting their class interests. They're voting their perceived racial interests because obviously they're going to be victimized too going forward under the Trump administration. Many of these white women are not necessarily voting gender. They're voting their racial interests too. And that oftentimes goes unexamined. The racism of white male workers is examined, but the racism involved in white women's voting pattern and their capitulation, oftentimes the male supremacy and patriarchy for whatever misguided reason, oftentimes does not go explained.
Well, Gerald, I would certainly concur that a fundamental fissure that no less is part of the DNA of this country, though, erupted with great, almost volcanic force, and that is the racism and the sexism and the xenophobia, which really is the bedrock of this country and was so easily able to be stoked and exploited by the Republican parties with the Trumpian presidency. Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you always for your astute critique. And we are moving on to Francis Fox Piven, who's an internationally renowned social scientist, scholar, and activist whose commitment to poor and working people and to the democratic cause has never wavered and place her among, I think, the ranks of the most important social scientists of the last century. And it's good to have you with us.
Incredible moment. I am stunned. It is horrifying that Donald Trump is going to be president of the most powerful country on earth, a country that now is at war all over the Middle East and is likely to be at war in more places with Trump as leader. I mean, this man is vastly ignorant, tempestuous, vainglorious, and he is going to have his finger on the button.
Francis, what do you think this says about the country? You know, we had on Dr. Gerald Horn, and who rooted so much of this in racism, in xenophobia, in gender bias, and sexism. But
all of those things are true. It's a moment to reconnoiter, because a lot of people voted for Trump, and they voted for him even though they knew that he was a misogynist, a racist, a liar, a thief.
Dr. Horn was saying that he does, and he rejects the notion in large part that it's about economic security. As he points out, there are fissures within the working class, and there's the black working class, and there's the white working class, the white blue-collar working class, and the black working class certainly didn't vote reactionary. Those that did come out, and they came out in somewhat smaller numbers than would have been hoped for, and certainly less than they did for President Obama. Again, the pivotal aspect of that is to understand how critical the issue of the racism is that is the trigger point for their support to the election of Donald Trump, that is the pivotal issue, that issue of racism of the white working class that lends itself to support for an absolute reactionary, or some would suggest a proto-fascist.
But, you know, there's a connection between the this vitriolic expression of racism and the experience of economic insecurity. Right-wing populism generally takes the form of blaming some other marginal group for the pain that people do indeed experience. And there's no question that it's been a very turbulent time for the white working class. They are losing ground. Although I do have to say that I don't think at the forefront of the Tea Party and the Trump movements that working class people are at the forefront of it. They are, large numbers of them are going along with it. But it's the petty bourgeoisie that are the ones that are really the most adamant. They're the strongest Tea Partiers in public opinion polls. And these are people who are not suffering economically. They're a little bit better off than the population as a whole. They're white, and they're older, sort of on the edge of retirement. We've seen that before, too. This particular strata, the people who are maybe the vice president of a local bank in a small town, who have that kind of occupational role, they feel embittered by a black president, by youth culture, by the open display of all sorts of sexual preferences. This makes them anxious and angry. It makes them feel that they're no longer at the center of American culture. They imagine a past when everybody lived in a small town and there was a church steeple at the center of the town, and they were the leaders of that small town. I don't know if it ever was like that for very many people, but that's their image of the way it should be, and that's why they yell at their rallies, the Tea Party I'm talking about now. They yell, take it back, take it back, take it back. For this vitriolic group that has been very important since Barack Obama became president, it is not really economic pain. It is a sense of being displaced by a country with a majority of immigrants, youth, gays, women, and so on.
Perhaps if you can continue on that theme, because I think you put your thumb on it with the petty bourgeoisie. Some people seem to have been surprised by, for example, white college-educated women who voted in much higher numbers than expected for Donald Trump as well. And I would maintain that what you're saying is there is still that petty bourgeois a sense of cultural displacement, which is in its root and at its core a kind of white privilege that is driving their discontent.
That's right. It is a sense that they've lost their standing, they've lost status in American culture, and they have, and they're going to be marginalized in American politics unless we become a full-blown fascist country. In that sense, they have lost something. But what they have lost is not their blue-collar job, because that's not what they were doing. However, I think a lot of working-class people do go along because he is a candidate of change, or so it's said. I mean, we don't know what he's going to do as president, do we? Hard to predict.
And then, of course, there's the projection of Rudy Giuliani as Chris Christie as Attorney General, John Bolton returning as Secretary of State. I mean, a source.
Think about the Supreme Court.
I try not to.
Ginsburg cannot hold out very much longer, I wouldn't think.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to have Certainly he one, could have but maybe three.
He could have three, and the federal courts, certainly the large number of vacancies on the federal court throughout the country, which actually in many ways have more immediate influence on issues, of course, from criminal justice issues, the issues of the death penalty, all kinds of issues with state voting considerations, and certainly we understand the right to choose is very much in play now. Yeah, it's I'm trying not to be overwhelmed. What do you say to the left? How do you look at the nature of our organizing in the past years? Is there other ways of embedding ourselves and really trying to build that mass movement?
Well, I think that actually the important social movements at this moment in time have been pretty good and pretty successful. I count among those movements Occupy, the Fight for 15, Black Lives Matter, but we do need to reconnoiter, try to figure out fruitful left progressive politics in this new context, because the movements grew because the electoral context was not hostile. There was an overlap between Obama's constituency and the movement constituency, for example, which tempered reactions, both rhetorical and police reactions, to the movements. Now, I think that's always true. Movements actually flourish in a more benign electoral climate. Movements do better when the Democrats are in power. Just look at the New Deal, the civil rights movement. It's not because electoral politics is in some ways is not good for movements. It tends to absorb, co-opt, and so forth some of the leaders. But at the same time, there is a complementary relationship between elected politicians, the center, and the left, and the movements. We don't have that now, and we've got to figure out how that changes what we do. One thing I am convinced of, however, is that a certain tendency I have been hearing lately to think that we just have to talk to these people, we have to educate them by, you know, sticking our tongues in their ears or something. You can't talk to hard right people and change their minds. That's an illusion. What does sometimes change people's minds is when they get caught up in a movement. We tend to think that first you straighten out people's heads and then they are recruits to the movement. Mm-hmm. I don't think it happens that way. I think that some degree of participation in the movement is really what changes a lot of people's minds, changes what they think is possible and what they're willing to do to make possible. But having said that, I also have to say, I don't have a prescription right now. I'm trying to figure out what happened and what we can do.
Always your thoughts on the matter are insightful and helpful. Frances Fox Piven, it's always enriching to have you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.